The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition. So what's coming up here on the EDU show or shows as we move forward? We're going to revisit our retirement planning philosophy and process. We did this through a five-part series about 4 years ago now. I think we did it in 2020, about the same time of the year, and we felt it was time to kind of revisit that and expand on it and kind of share the latest evolution of what we're doing here in the office. And we're actually going to start off today with a bit of a prequel, where we're going to examine an article that was actually just released on Bloomberg that is entitled Wall Street Just Doesn't Get Retirement. And we're going to share it because they kind of point out a few of the things that form some of the things that drives our philosophy on retirement planning. So today will be kind of a, you know, beginning of the philosophy, I guess. It won't really be into our process too much. That'll come moving forward, and we're going to do this a little differently than we did last time. Last time was just a kind of back-to-back five-part series where we just pushed out information about the why of what we do and then how we do it. We're going to share the secret sauce, really, of how we put things together when we look at a retirement projection for clients that we happen to work with. This time, we're going to mix it up a little bit and make it a little more interactive, and we're going to make it kind of a blend with our discussion threads, if you will, the way we've been doing it, where we're going to ask you to follow along and send us in your questions and comments about what we're going through over the next several shows. My guess is it's going to be 5 to 7 shows as we go through this, because we're going to kind of, in not so much real time, because this isn't a live show with people on the line, but we're going to each week pull up questions that have come up from the show that we just released, where people share their thoughts, and we can kind of incorporate that or weave that through our description of the why and how we do things as part of our approach. So that's kind of where we're headed. That's probably going to take us to the end of May or so, which is going to be probably perfect timing to lead into June, which is each and every year Annuity Awareness Month, where we usually dedicate a fair amount of the shows to annuity topics. So that's what we're going to fit in here. Now we're kind of not quite midway through April, but the last part of April and most all of May is going to be what we're attacking with our replacement, I guess, for the five-part series we did 4 years ago or so, that I know a lot of you have listened to, because we've encouraged those who want to really learn about our process and approach. That's the great place to do it, is in that five-part series. But we're going to freshen it up, give it a new twist, and start with a real little prequel today. So, Jim, I know you're the one who stumbled across this article, so I'll kind of let you lead the way with where you want to take us with regards to that. But
Okay.
Excellent. I will say I'm leaning more towards 7 shows, not 5. But we might wrap it up in 5, but I doubt it, since the original series was 5 shows long. And that didn't even count the tax show that we added or the investment management show. So I really hope it's kind of borrowing folks a little bit, too, from the suggestions from some people to spice up our Q&A shows. And, of course, Chris has graciously offered to broadcast our Q&A shows topless permanently.
Well, wait a minute. Did you get any feedback about that from last time?
Nothing on you being topless. I think people were shocked and kind of enjoyed it.
I wouldn't blame them for being shocked. So feel free to not support that direction in the show.
But Chris will willingly broadcast Q&A shows topless to add spice and excitement.
If I have to, I will.
If you have to, you will. Yeah. But what I also intend to do is for this whole series, which is not, if you're a longtime listener, you know, it's not just pushing and saying, oh, you guys got to hire us. It's not what we do. And longtime listeners know we had paused anyways with accepting new retirement plan clients. It's really just sharing with you not only the how, but the why. Why do we do this? Why do we do that? It's part of the reason I wanted to lead with this article, because it's going to allow us to share a lot of the why we do things with the author of this article and what they pointed out. But I also intend to incorporate the Q&A shows into this whole series and marry this series to our concept we call dialogue. And I'm really going to encourage our listeners, especially the, well, longtime listeners or new listeners. If you're new, you're going to have questions on what are you guys talking about? Can you add some clarity? And if you're a longtime listener, it's a perfect opportunity for you to ask specific questions or make comments. Hey, guys, I love how you do this, but I think you're idiots for doing that. Share it with us. We can handle it. But it's going to be an opportunity to engage our listeners, not only in why we do things the way we do and how we do things, but what you guys are doing and why. What do you like about our approach? What don't you like about our approach? And if we dedicate entire Q&A shows to this dialogue, so be it. We don't have to lead with Social Security questions all the time. We can mix it up. But I see the next 5 to 7 to probably 8 shows all being dedicated on this, and both Q&A and EDU. Although there will be a dedicated Q&A with our taxateer, Paul. We spoke with him today. There's some issues, some personal issues, but if all goes well, he may be able to appear not on this Saturday's Q&A show, but the following Saturday. And if I open up my iPhone, my trusty little iPhone, that would be the 20th. So perhaps the Q&A show on the 20th will involve our taxateer, Paul. So if you have any tax-related questions, please put in the subject line tax question, or tax question for Paul, or tax question for the taxateers, whatever you want. Just let me know in the subject line it's a tax question. And I drag it now into my tax folder. And we hope, we can't say for certain because of some issues Paul's addressing, but if everything is going well, we will have him on the 20th. So that will be a little divergence from what I just described to you. But outside of that, I'm hoping the EDU shows and the Q&A shows marry dialogue with Q&A, with EDU, with our process and approach. That's one hell of a big marriage. That's like one of those Reverend Moon marriages where thousands of people are getting married. Well, this is our Reverend Moon marriage of our show, and trying to add a little bit of excitement so Chris doesn't have to keep broadcasting while topless. All right.
I know, of all the people to mention on the Retirement and IRA show, I never imagined Reverend Moon would come up on the show.
See how my brain works? Just could pull
it
somehow.
I'm not sure how it works, actually. It's a conundrum.
Well, isn't he the Korean guy who marries
a
bunch of people at once?
No, you got it, which is also a little surprising since you're so bad at names that you actually did have the right name attached to the right person.
And I've never married, so go figure. Yeah. I have no idea. Okay. Anyways, folks, this article literally just came off the presses. And I forget if it was over the weekend. I don't know if it was in the morning or in the evening. I don't know. It's a blur. It came across one of the emails. I subscribe to all these different emails. I get hundreds and hundreds of emails a day. So sometimes that's why, if you're wondering how come I never replied, that's probably why. But I get all these emails of articles I might want to read. And what I liked about this one was the title. And I don't have the title anymore. I told you, Chris, what the title was.
It's Wall Street Just Doesn't Get Retirement.
Wall Street Just Doesn't Get Retirement. And that title lured me in. So I went to Bloomberg's website, and it wouldn't let me print, or I didn't know what I was doing, one or the other. So I had to copy and paste the article into a Word document, and I didn't copy and paste the title. But Chris wanted to see the article before today's show, so I just Googled the author's name, Allison Schrager, and April 4th, 2024. So you all can do that and access this article. We also, Chris, I know you have the link to the article. Do you do me a favor right now and send that to Jacob and tell him to put it in the show notes that he's going to do so I don't have to do that? Thank you. So if you look in the show notes as well, folks, Jacob will post a link to Allison's article. Allison turns out to be, her job title is a job title I never knew even existed. She is a retirement economist. So I would guess she's an economist who specializes in retirement. But when I saw the title of the article and the summary that I read in my email that was sent to me said a retirement economist talks about the dysfunction of American retirement and something about how Wall Street doesn't get it. And I thought that would be interesting. So I read the article and I thought, you know what? This is a good prequel to what we're going to be doing. So as Chris and I have done in the past, we're just going to read through the article and add our thoughts to what Allison, a retirement economist, is saying, because I think she makes some very good points. But a lot of what she's mentioning ties into why we do things one way and why we don't do things another way. And it might also give food for thought to you guys. So you can look up the article yourself. You can read it. You can feel free to opine on it. And again, play along with what we're trying to do over the next 2 months or so on the EDU and Q&A show. And let's get a good dialogue going and let's all learn together. And that's probably going to be my final tease, Chris, before I jump into this. Chris and I are going to share with you something different in how we model and approach retirement in our process. Everybody knows our process. We have named the Secure Retirement Income Process. And it involves a lot of concepts unique to our firm, and unique to me and with Chris's help with him, of terms that we've come up with and use regularly. Minimum dignity floor, secure income, which in and of itself isn't overly unique. See-through portfolio, investment positioning. Of course, the name, Secure Retirement Income Process. And the granddaddy of them all, the fund number. These are all concepts that my firm came up with. That, yes, I came up with, I take pride in that, and that Chris assisted me with. Now, none of these terms are used in her article, but some of what she mentions can be understood with some of the approach that we take to retirement. And that's kind of why I wanted to lead with this prequel. Chris, did you have, I know I kind of sent this to you just like 30 minutes ago. Did you have time to read the whole thing?
I skimmed through it. I didn't read every single word, no.
Okay, no problem. I will. So let's start going through it. And yeah, we should be able to get this done in time. It's only 4 pages. Okay. She begins her article. She doesn't begin on the website. You know, I don't know what they did. They do a call out where they take like a little quote from the article and it leads. And the call out caught my attention. The goal of retirement plans should be providing income to those no longer working, not accumulating wealth for those who still are. Thought that was interesting because income plays a very big role in Allison's article. And remember, she is a retirement economist. Okay, she begins. As a retirement economist, not to be confused with a retired economist. So I kind of liked it right off the bat, Chris. She began with humor. Mm-hmm. Not to be confused with a retired economist, which are rare, I often find myself talking to Wall Street types who happen to be in charge of a lot of other people's money. The conversations vary, but the takeaway almost never does. As a senior executive at a large asset management firm recently said to me, with surprising candor, we don't know how to solve the retirement problem. Anything you want to say about that first paragraph?
No, not yet.
Okay. People might be saying, what's the problem? She goes on to explain it. By problem, he was referring to the declining share of Americans who view their retirement plans as on track. And by quote-unquote we, he was referring to the financial industry, which, to be fair, has made some progress in offering various kinds of accounts and ways of savings, but it is still getting the big things wrong. The only thing I'll add to what Allison wrote there, it wasn't the financial industry that has made progress in offering various types of accounts and ways of saving. It's Congress. Eventually, they do get off their asses and actually do things besides sit around complaining about each other, and they do get some things done. And over the past decade, maybe 15 to 10-year period, they definitely have been making massive changes. Indexing for inflation, the amount you can contribute, adding catch-up contributions, adding target date funds as the default investment option when it used to be cash in the past. Under Secure 1 and Secure 2, adding annuities to 401k plans, which again is in their infancy and many 401ks don't have them yet, but they're working on trying to improve that. Automatic enrollment into 401ks as the default. In the past, people had to choose to enroll and apathy and neglect took over and few people started saving for retirement. Standardizing and authorizing and allowing automatic increases in people's pay that goes into 401ks without their, I don't want to say without their permission, because they give the permission when they first enroll, kind of like when you join a website, you pretty much give away everything, including your firstborn male child, when you first enroll in something. That's what happens now. So employers can automatically increase the money going in from their employees. They can index it for inflation. They can have catch-ups and default investment options that grow. And so all of this, folks, is Congress. It's not Wall Street. Wall Street, they're still just trying to gather your assets and charge you an AUM fee, which pisses me off, as everybody knows. But that's what Wall Street's doing. Wall Street isn't doing diddly squat. except trying to take your money. At least Congress is trying to address this. Okay, I digress. Anything you want to add there, Chris?
Well, at times I will say Wall Street can be creative in offering new things to sell you, ways to put your money to use. So they, you know, I think you were not giving them enough credit for the things that they do, but it's through their lens of what's important, different ways for people to invest that we can help them with. And that's pretty much end of story. It's not different ways we can help people with retirement. It's really about different ways we can help people invest their money.
You're much too kind, because to me, it's different ways to get your money over to them to add unnecessary complexity to the entire process to make you. When I say you folks, I mean the general public. If you're listening to this podcast, you're not falling to their gimmicks. But ways to complicate matters to get you to think you need them, and ways for them to, and I can't say this word, help me out,
obfuscate.
That's the word. How do you say it again?
Obfuscate.
Mm-hmm. And it means, hopefully I'm getting the right word. I just know it means like make cloudy, difficult to track and see.
Yep.
Am I on track with what that word means?
Nailed it. Just don't try to say it.
I won't try to say the word. The word Chris says. That's what they try to do with their damn fees, folks. They try to hide it in all of this stuff. In 12B1 fees and revenue sharing agreements and platform fees and custodial fees and commissions. And of course, the quote unquote fees, like there's like some sort of pure little fee that they're going to charge you. Advisory fee. It sounds pure as the driven snow. We've already been down that road. Chris is much too forgiving of my industry. And that's fine. That's his opinion. My opinion of the industry, it's all smoke and mirrors trying to subtract you from your money. Okay, I digress. All right, she continues, people have no idea how much money they need to retire. I think we agree there, Chris. Sadly, we sometimes work with people who contacted us too late. They should have contacted us 3, 5, 6 years sooner. And some have already retired. Only for us to say, to us, the numbers don't seem to be adding up. And they thought it added up, but they never really analyzed it closely. And then when someone who steps in or on their own, when they finally learn how to do it, they're starting to realize, wow, maybe we retired too early. So I will agree with this economist. People have no idea how much money they need to retire. Their estimate of the costs of retirement increased 50% in the last 4 years, even though life expectancy barely changed. If anything, they should have revised their estimates lower, because higher interest rates mean they need less money to retire. This shows how poor the financial industry has educated people on what retirement costs and what kind of assets they need. But there is some good news. More employers than ever offer retirement benefits, and automatic enrollment has increased worker participation and improved how investments are made. The 2022 SECURE Act should expand coverage even further. Today's Americans have more money saved than in previous generations. Yet at the same time, Americans are now living longer, and there is no political appetite to encourage people to retire later. That means the number of years Americans are spending in retirement will increase, so they will need even more income. I think there's a lot of truth to what she's saying there. And I know FIRE people, financial independence, retire early, they'll dispute a lot of this. And I have met at least one successful FIRE person, but I don't know too much about that, but she does say, and she is making sense, people are living longer, but the politicians lack the appetite to encourage people to retire later. What she's talking about there, folks, is increasing the Social Security retirement age. Not to people listening to this podcast. I'm not freaking out on it. If you're listening to this podcast, chance, and you're in your late 50s, 60s, you've already been forced to work longer because Reagan and a bipartisan Congress enacted that in 83, where they extended the retirement age out. It is now 2024. Hell of a lot longer. 40 plus years since that has happened. It's time to extend it longer because people are living longer. And what's the issue? If we tell 20 and 30 year olds that they have a full retirement age now, instead of 67, their full retirement age is 68 or 68 and a half or 69. Oh, horror. They're going to bitch. They're going to moan about it. Let them. That's what social media is for. They're going to rant and rave and scream and shout and holler. The problem is Washington is so decrepit and idiotic. One party will use it against the other party as a sledgehammer to try to push them out of office rather than trying to truly get a handle on Social Security. I feel, Chris, this is what she was referencing, was Congress's appetite to not say we're going to push out the retirement age or to try to scare people our age into saying, oh my God, you thought you only had to work to 67? They're going to make it 70. Don't vote for them. That's not what they're going to do. They're going to do something, or they need to do something similar to what Congress and the Reagan administration did in 83, which is just acknowledge people are living longer. You can retire earlier. You're just not going to get your full benefit. You got to wait another year, year and a half or two. And Chris, what's one of the best ways to improve the success of a retirement plan that might be running a little tight? Is it running out and buying the most aggressive investment you can find, or is it doing something else?
Well, for a lot of people, if they can afford to do it, and not everyone can, so kind of depends on the crowd we're talking to, but for a lot of people, waiting to claim your Social Security makes a big difference in what we call longevity protection, which is one of the biggest issues in retirement. And kind of what they're alluding to, the author's talking about living longer. The risk of living longer than your money lasts is a real thing. And taking steps to mitigate that risk, I think, is one of the fundamental ways people can improve their overall retirement. And one way to do that is waiting to collect your Social Security benefits. Now, not everyone can. Now, I think everybody who was, if they were warned with enough time to plan, so we're talking 20s and 30-somethings, that they could be prepared for it. I do think there's a lot of people that retirement kind of sneaks up on them and they realize that they didn't do the proper planning and Social Security becomes a huge part of their ability to retire. And if they physically are unable to work or their job, there's age discrimination, they might lose their job before they intend, or work a job that is so physically demanding they can't work another year and a half would be impossible for them. For those kind of people, it is very challenging. But I think if as long as they apply these changes to a young enough generation that can build it into their assumptions and what they know is going to happen, then if 40 years later it come, you face that situation and you didn't plan for it, then a lot of the blame has to go on you if you chose to do other things rather than prepare for working an extra year or something like that. So I think it doesn't have to be such a political issue. And not that I was paying that much attention to it back in the 1980s, because at the time I was like a typical 20-something who didn't really pay that much attention to retirement and that sort of thing. So as these changes were being put forth, I didn't pay that much attention to it, so I don't recall there being a big uproar in the increase in retirement age from 66 to 67. But there may very well have been. Some of the older folks out there might clue me in as to what kind of screaming and yelling there was at that time. But right now it seems like Everybody, even when it's mentioned, just has a conniption fit about it.
That's all true. But where I was also going with this was one of the single best things you can do. Yes, extend Social Security, as Chris said, and not everyone can afford to do that.
And work a little longer.
Work a little longer.
Getting ready to do that. Yeah.
Yep. That can sometimes be the difference to success and failure. Work 2, 3, 4, 5 years longer. Now, not everybody wants to or can do that. Mm-hmm. Some people have very physically demanding jobs and their bodies can't handle it. Other people may not have physically demanding jobs, but their mind just can't handle it. They just don't want to do it anymore. We acknowledge that. It's easy for us as retirement planners to say, just work a little longer. Or for me, someone who always says, I don't have a job, I have a life. I just love what I do. But not everybody has that. I fully acknowledge that. But I can tell you, stripping away the physicality and stripping away the emotionality of everything, at a pure financial level, working longer, especially later in life, because there's nothing you can buy with a compounded return over an extra 1, 2, 3, 4 years that's going to make a difference. But working longer, pulling in your peak salary, hopefully, and delaying the debiting of your assets while continuing to add to them, that can make sometimes the biggest difference in the world. Mm-hmm. And maybe not so much again to you who are listening to this podcast, but your friends and family and colleagues who are not VGs, who are not totally into this, can make a huge difference for them. So she continues, there's no way around the fact a well-funded retirement free of financial risk is incredibly expensive. Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, points out in his annual shareholders letter that the shift to defined contribution plans, such as 401ks, meant that individuals, instead of corporations, carry all the risk. Now, that's true, what Mr. Fink is saying, and I agree with him on that. And it's something we have been talking about for years. It's talking about anybody knows that. When the companies got rid of defined benefit pension plans and said, hey, we'll define our contribution, hence the name defined contribution plans. We're not going to define the benefit, hence the name defined benefit plans, which is what pensions are called. We're not going to tell you how much you're going to walk away with in income if you work for us for 30 years. But we are going to define to you how much we're going to give you to put into your retirement account. But it's totally up to you to make this all work, not us. I mean, that was something that corporate America wanted to do. That's why really pensions today only exist to unions and governments, two entities that are devoid of all economic reality. And that's where you find often pensions still exist. Now, there's a couple of industries, legacy industries, that might not fall into the union or government category that still offer pensions. But for the most part, unions and governments is where, especially government unions, is where you're going to find pensions. Other than that, most corporations realize this is freaking hard. We're going to pass this risk on to people. But the government, which allowed this to happen, never simultaneously said, people are dumb. We've got to help them understand what they're getting themselves into and how to keep from being taken advantage of from the people who are going to, quote unquote, manage their money. Read another way, take 10, 20, 30% of their annual earnings in fees. We have to educate them on all this. Well, that's where the government failed miserably. But at the same time, they gave massive handouts to Wall Street, in my oh-so-humble opinion, in the sense that they created these accounts with now trillions and trillions of assets that Wall Street gets to manage. So keeping people dumb on how all of this works, getting people to think it's so complex you can't do it yourself, and obfuscating the fee structure in such a manner people have no idea what the heck it is they're paying, keeps Wall Street fat and happy, and people struggling to retire. So what's some of the solutions, or what is a solution perhaps? Well, this retirement economist continues. So again, I kind of diverged there, so I'll repeat the last sentence. Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, points out in his annual shareholder letter that the shift to defined contribution plans, such as a 401k, meant that individuals, instead of corporations, carried all the risk. Now, she disagrees with that a little. She says, this is partially true. Though defined benefit plans, or a pension plan, folks, had more risk than many of their beneficiaries realized, and firms often underestimated the cost of bearing that risk. This is why defined benefit plans have become so rare in the private sector. I kind of agree with what she's saying there, but I don't think what Mr. Fink said is partially true. I think it's fully true. He said, again, individuals instead of corporations carry all the risk. And he is correct. In a defined contribution plan, your corporation doesn't carry the investment risk, the longevity risk, the interest rate risk, the inflation risk. You do. They carry, I guess you could say, liability risk, that they might be sued for not having a well-structured and low-cost plan. And they carry funding risk, where they have to make sure they have the money to put in on your behalf. But since their match is not legal requirement, and it can be in some union contracts, but they can cut your match at any time. Absolutely. They're not obligated to make the match. They're going to try to, but if they can't, they won't. So I still think the risk is on the shoulders of the individual. So I disagree when she says it's partially true. Now, she is correct, in my opinion, that defined benefit plans did have more risk than most participants in the defined benefit plan realized, and firms often underestimated the cost of that risk. But the government tried to clean that up in 73 with the passage of what is now known as ERISA, where they put in protections and funding minimums, and they started backstopping these pensions through the federal government in a program called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, where they helped insure pension benefits, and they mandated certain interest rates to be used to project the funding of pensions. And the government tried to clean up a lot of the issues. By cleaning it up, it made it more expensive.
Yeah, and that was really the key issue. The actuaries and the regulators pointed out and made transparent, at least to a degree, the fact that most of these plans were underfunded. A lot of them were, and therefore precarious for their longevity. And it was all a choice by the company to not put as much money in. To defend the actuaries of the world, they were screaming, you need to put in this amount, you need to put in this amount to maintain the proper funding level, and the companies chose not to do it. So a lot of that was self-inflicted on their part. Now, some are the realities of the economics of the company, where maybe you could argue they couldn't afford to do it. Well, it is certainly possible. But the fact is, the pension itself would have been fine if properly funded.
Right. And to me, this ERISA, and ERISA was a much needed law. I'm not bashing ERISA. But ERISA shed the light on the cockroach in the room, which was that companies were underfunding their pensions and the liabilities. ERISA shone the light on it. That caused the cockroaches to scatter. But what it also displayed to companies, or incentivized them, was, well, if we're going to have to actually fund this where it's going to be actuarially sound, especially in the difficult high inflationary times back then, they said, we need another way of doing this. And that's when the 401k was created. Technically by an act of Congress, because Congress writes the tax code, But oh gosh, I can't remember. How do I remember Reverend Moon? But I can't remember.
I forget.
Isn't it Benya? Benya? Tom Benya? Benya? Father? Google father of the 401k.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Actually.
It's Tom Benya or Benya or something like that. He's the one who kind of created a 401k for a banking client of his by analyzing Section 401k of the tax code, and he kind of thought, I think this can be done. And I remember reading an interview with him years ago where he kind of said when he created this for his banking client, the banking client was happy, but no one else really called or did anything. And he wanted to kind of market it and be a consultant on how to create these for companies. Remember, they didn't exist. And then the New York Times, I think in 82, but I could be wrong on that. If it's 82, that's from pure memory, did a story on them. And as he said in the article, my phone hadn't stopped ringing after. Did you find the guy's name?
Benna. So I don't know exactly how you pronounce it, but Tom Benya.
And Tom Benya. See, I can remember that. I remember the weirdest things. But that's how 401ks were created. I think ERISA led to that. When they had to start properly funding their accounts, they were looking for ways out. What's the takeaway for you listeners, though? Where am I going with this? That's how damn expensive funding retirement can be. And it's just not easy. And this is with risk pooling together hundreds, if not thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of employees together. Knowing some will die and support those who are alive, and some will live way too long for any actuarial means for drawing money, but everyone else will support them. That's risk pooling. They took that away. You are gone. You are on your own. If you approach retirement, especially to expenses we call the minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, just trying to fund it with your assets, that can be incredibly difficult. Maybe, again, not so much for the typical listener of this podcast, but for the 85% of Americans, and that's just a guess. I don't know how much it is. It's not scientific. But the 85% of Americans out there who have no clue what's coming their way. Not you guys. You're listening to this because you know how difficult this is. But there's no risk pooling anymore with a defined contribution plan. Look how hard it was when you could share the risk. Now you're doing it on your own, but so many people enter into it blindly, just thinking, oh, this is easy. And it's not. Okay. Anything you want to add before I continue?
Nope. I think we're ready to move on.
Okay. Then it continues. Defined contribution pensions don't have such a clear goal. Often their brochures talk about I missed an important sentence before that. Employers who offered defined benefit plans did get one thing right, however. They understood the risk and problems they faced providing certain income in retirement. Yes, that's why they got out when ERISA forced them to fully fund pensions, and they realized from their actuaries how expensive and difficult this was going to be. Tom Benya came around at the right time and gave them the way out. And again, that's why governments and unions still have them, because they don't operate in economic reality. So she continues, defined contribution pensions don't have such a clear goal. Often their brochures talk about income, but the strategies appear more geared towards achieving a certain level of wealth. Most investors, as well as the retirement industry, judge the success of their retirement portfolio on its value on any given day, or over some arbitrary period of time, or on how much money it will have on day one of retirement. She is so spot on. I have often said, you want to improve retirement in America? Don't show people the balance of their 401ks on a whim every day, every second. That's where the irrational emotions take over. And 20, 30, 40 somethings who should be jumping in the street, dancing with rain, that markets are dropping. They should be so excited because they're buying things on sale. But instead, they're programmed to fear it and make stupid, irrational decisions, like pulling out of the market after it's dropped 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50%. And you're only 35, 40, 45 years old. Stupid. Should be throwing more money in. Statements instead should be showing you how many shares in your investment you are buying each month. So when the markets are dropping, you should be sitting there saying, wow, for the same dollars, I got 8 more shares. Wow, I got 11 more shares. Wow, I got 4 more shares. But no, you're instead looking at your balance and panicking because something you're going to need in 40 or 50 years is down. That, to me, is one of the ways to clean up this quote-unquote problem, as she led with. Don't let people see their frickin' statements. Or maybe just show it to them once a year. Just show them you're buying more shares. Anyways, continue going. Anything you want to add on this, Chris?
Nope. Go ahead.
You're very easy on this. You're not adding much. Okay. But the goal of retirement finance isn't your wealth on a particular day. Get a load of this, folks. Where have you heard something like this before? Her next sentence. It is predictable income for the length of your retirement. Where have you heard something like that similar, Chris? Any idea?
Well, there's a lot of people who actually talk that way. The challenge is deciding how much of that income is right for you, which is where, you know, we're going to head in this ultimately in this multi-part series, because I think that's one thing that sets our approach apart from a lot is we have a formal way of defining what we believe to be the appropriate minimum level of income to consider to have a strong foundation to your retirement. So the concept of let's have income in retirement, you know, the insurance folks out there that are listening are cheering that on because they talk about that all the darn time because they happen to represent a company and a product that might very well provide that income, and they harp on that income idea a lot. So it's not earth-shattering, you know, to talk about income in retirement. I do think the 401ks of the world, the wealth managers of the world don't talk about income enough, but there's quite a few people out there that do talk about it. We just have our own specific approach to it, which will come out over the following shows if you're not familiar with it already.
Excellent. Okay, she continues. It is predictable income for the length of your retirement. Getting this basic premises wrong burdens retirees with an enormous and intractable risk. Take the common target date fund. And here I'm going to disagree with a little bit about what she's writing. And she's right, but she's also wrong in a sense. I'll explain what I mean. She writes, take the common target date fund. And for anybody who doesn't know what a target date fund is, that's the fund in your 401k that is most likely the default investment option. And it's the fund that might have a name like the XYZ Target Retirement Fund, but it'll have a number after it, usually in 5-year increments, but sometimes it could be in yearly increments or 3-year increments. But you might see the 2020, 2025, 2030, 2035, 2040. That's called a target date fund. On its premise, you're supposed to choose the fund whose year, in its title, whose year closest resembles or matches the estimated year you anticipate retiring. And then you're supposed to throw your money in that, and the fund is professionally managed, that as the year gets closer and closer, ostensibly the fund gets more and more conservative. Now, we could dedicate and have in the past and probably should again in the future, but it wouldn't be until July or August at this point, do a whole show on target date funds, the pros, the cons, what I like about them, what I don't like about them. I think as an accumulation vehicle for people in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, people who don't have that VG attitude like you guys have, people who wouldn't know an ETF from a mutual fund if it was staring them in the face, people who don't know the difference between an IRA and a Roth, people who just, I know you're going to find this hard to believe, folks, just don't like this stuff or take it seriously. I think target date funds are a godsend for them. I don't think they're a good holding for someone in the transition phase and the distribution phase. So I do think Congress needs to clean this up a little and get people to know you should consider target date funds until you get within 5, 8 or so years of retirement. And you're going to want to start looking at things a little differently. Sadly, they don't do that. And people end up holding target date funds much, much too long. And I've shared in the past the story of a deputy sheriff who used to live up in the mountains where I used to live. And this deputy was not my good friend Rob, who sadly passed away, but it was another deputy sheriff up there. And he wanted to retire in 2010. And he asked his 401k, didn't have a 401a, they had a 401a. He asked the company that managed the custodian of the 401a provided people to talk to deputies to get them to understand their investments. And anyways, his story was that he asked this person, and it was prior to 2008. I don't know if it was 2005, 6, 7, whatever. I don't know. He told him, I want to retire in 2010. This guy told him, well, put all your money in the 2010 fund. That's what this is designed for. And in 2008, when stocks tanked, this fund lost 30%+. I don't know the exact amount. Memory, 32, 33, but I could be wrong. But it was 30%+. This deputy was livid. And it highlights some of the problems with target date funds. This one was called a through fund, not a to fund, and I'm not going to get into it. But the point was, it was an inappropriate fund for his stage of retirement, the transition phase. He had a couple of more years to go before retirement, and he shouldn't have had all money in this fund, especially because it was a through target date fund, not a to target date fund. And we will do a series of this in July and August, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So I kind of like target date funds for accumulation vehicles. I think they fail miserably in transition and distribution. Mm-hmm. But they do make it easy for people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s to get instant diversification at relatively low cost, especially inside a 401k. Relatively low cost, and you don't have to pay an investment advisor 1.25%, 1.5% of your assets. And there's all these platforms now that are coming out to allow investment advisors to charge and manage your 401k for them to throw yet an AUM fee on assets that they can't normally touch until you retire, and they convince you to move your money to an IRA. There's one company out there, Chris, now I'm going to go on a little tangent here, but there's one company who's pushing this platform as a way of getting around the pending DOL law or rule that's going to make moving money from a 401k even more difficult. Screw it. Don't move it. Keep it there. You can still charge on it. This is their whole claim to fame. Beat the DOL at their own game. Leave it in the 401k, but still grow your AUM. Oh, I get so angry over this. Can you tell?
I can tell.
But these target date funds, which they hate and bash, make it very easy, at least for 20, 30, 40-year-olds. Maybe even 50, 55-year-olds if you're still going to retire at 65 or 70. But I do feel target date funds drop the ball in the transition and distribution phase. Okay, let's continue. Where the hell did I leave off? Take the Target Date Fund, which invests young savers in stocks and moves them into bonds as they age. This strategy aims to grow their money and keep their assets from falling too much in value as they approach retirement. I disagree with you there. You might be a very, very smart retirement economist, but I've just explained to you that deputy, he lost 30%+ of his money in 2008, and he had the 2010 retirement one, Target Date Fund, because it was a through fund and didn't explain that to him. Okay, she continues. But it does nothing, Target Date Fund she's referencing, does nothing to help them, employees, know how much to spend each year, or let alone how to maintain that level of spending. Here's where I disagree again with her. It's not the Target Date Fund's responsibility to do a financial plan or a retirement plan. They are just an investment. They're not interviewing every shareholder in that mutual fund and teaching them and finding out about them. That's not even the responsibility of the employer. The employer is supposed to offer someone who can answer questions about the funds, but not necessarily do a retirement plan. Now, some employers do offer that. We've seen that in our practice where people have said, hey, I've got X amount of dollars each year I can put into it's a benefit to pay a financial planner. Can you send me a receipt? I'm going to get reimbursed for this. We've seen that before. It's not common, but we have seen it. But it is not the responsibility of the Target Date Fund to help someone who bought that fund determine how much they can spend each year and how to maintain that level of spending. Anything you want to add to that?
No, I think a lot of people confuse a tool with a plan. And Target Date Funds, mutual funds, 401ks, IRAs, brokerage accounts, insurance products, those are all tools. They're not the plan. The plan is how you put the tools to best use to accomplish your goals. So don't confuse a tool for a plan.
Exactly. Well put. And she did there. Okay. The current most popular spending rules, and I think she's talking about the safe withdrawal rate, the current most popular spending rules leave retirees with huge yearly swings in income and vulnerable to the didn't think I'd get that word, did you? Vulnerable to the risk of running out of money. I think Chris and I would agree with this statement. And there's plenty more wrong with the safe withdrawal rate in our opinion, but they definitely do leave you. I wouldn't necessarily say huge, but they could be huge yearly swings in income. Although if you stick to the safe withdrawal rate, you're supposed to withdraw the same amount every year adjusted for inflation. Now, there's some that say you can always cut spending on fun in years that your portfolio is going down. Chris and I hate that, especially if it happens early in retirement. It's the whole concept that we came up with the fun number. And it's the whole basis of what we do once you protect your minimum dignity floor. We don't want you during the early years of retirement cutting spending on fun because your portfolio is down. Those could be years of fun you are never getting back. We're not 20s going on to 30s, going on to 40s, where we still have our youth and vigor. We're in our 60s, going into our 70s, going into our 80s. We all know how this ends, folks. We're not naive. We're not stupid. You're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier. And to cut spending the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of retirement on fun, those are 2, 3, 4, 5 years of spending on fun you're never getting back. Because trust me, every year, let alone every 5 years, you are aging. We're like dogs after the age of 7. They just seem to age really fast. I think after 50, we're like dogs. We're aging fast. And I just hate the safe withdrawal rate that says, well, in bad times, you can cut your spending on fun. As if that is not important. Oh, you don't have to spend on fun. You're going to retire, just sit around, eat bonbons, watch TV. That's what retirement is. You don't have to go out and do things on fun. No, no, no. Just keep giving me 1% of your assets and just cut your spending on fun, but not going to cut my fee. No. You're going to keep giving me 1% of your assets. Anything you want to add to that, Chris?
No, I think she's really dialing in the core stressors that traditional retirement planning, as we know it today, don't really address fully for most people. They just are not aware that solutions exist, and the traditional model, either on purpose or just through not knowing, doesn't point these things out to people that there might be a better way to look at this.
Well, she continues. Funny you say that. Solutions do exist. They begin by redefining the retirement problem as one of future income. Can you play the clap for that? Finally, someone gets it. Well, that didn't go quickly.
What?
I didn't hear any clapping. Did you clap?
Yeah,
oh,
I did,
we'll get that whole problem again, yeah, where I don't hear anything.
That's fine. Everyone else heard it. That was the important
Everyone
part.
Else heard it clapping but me. For some reason, folks, I don't hear the clapping. Solutions do exist. They begin by redefining the retirement problem as one of future income, not current wealth. If you're a longtime listener to this podcast, you know Chris and I value lifetime guaranteed income tremendously, especially when looked at in isolation to what we call your minimum dignity floor or your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. And we will get into this in much greater detail over the coming series of shows that we're going to be doing for you. We don't define success, at least when it comes to minimum dignity floor, with assets. We define it with a lifetime stream of income that will cover a series of expenses for the rest of your life, whether you have money or not, and expenses that will continue for the rest of your life, whether you have money or not. And even if you do have money, even if you have enough money where there's no doubt, net of any secure income you are privy to, whether it's Social Security, pension, or annuity, net of all that, you still have enough money to cover any shortage. We're still going to encourage, not require, encourage the older you to make the decision, not the younger you. You still might want to cover minimum dignity floor with lifetime guaranteed secure income because it's going to be easier for you to understand as you age. And yes, I know all you Vanguard VG types out there find this hard to believe, but there will be times where many of you, maybe not all of you, but many of you will not fully understand investing anymore, or might not quite be into it anymore. Or worse, Chris, they might be into it and they might be thinking they're doing good, but they're not. Because as you have pointed out many times, our ability to understand financial concepts begins to diminish at age 53, according to a very famous Harvard study. But according to an almost equally famous Texas Tech study, people, as they age, don't lose what, Chris?
The confidence they're making good decisions.
Exactly. And that is an elixir that doesn't mix. That's like oil and water. Declining financial capabilities, increasing or at least maintaining confidence. You think you're doing it right, but you're doing it wrong. And it exposes you to fraud and falling victim to financial fraud, which is why most fraudsters go after elderly people. And they send out all those junk emails that we can't believe anyone would be stupid enough to click on and believe the text in them. But they do. Why? They're elderly and they don't understand anymore. That's where income comes in handy. So she continues, and she's talking income. That means different benchmarks that treat retirement accounts like mini defined benefit plans and can assess how close a client is to reaching an income stream years from now. What might these benchmarks look like? They would involve converting asset balances into income by using long-term interest rate. The original SECURE Act, which, remember, folks, came out about 4 or 5 years ago now, requires that retirement account statements start to show an income estimate, but it is often secondary to the display of the asset balance. How well a saver is doing and whether the plan has offered suitable investments is still the benchmark to gauge wealth. And she's right on that. Now, I disagree with how SECURE Act is going to project the income. I mean, it's a step in the right direction, but it's not perfect. And I wish they put a little more forethought into it. But at least they're going to have to start projecting how much income you're generating or are on pace to generate. But they really have to change the story because people are still fixated on the lump sum. Give me, what was that show? Give me the money. Give me the money. No, not give me the money. It had Tom Cruise in it. Show me the money. Show me the money. Yeah, but what was it called?
Had Cuba
Eddie McGuire?
Yeah, but it was had Cuba Gooding Jr. in it.
Cuba Gooding Jr. was the athlete. Show me the money.
Yep.
I can't remember the name of the movie. Chris will Google it. But in that, it's show me the money. Show me the money. That's all people are interested in. You guys get bored by lifetime guaranteed secure income, which
Jerry
amazes
Maguire.
Me. Say what?
It was Jerry Maguire, not Eddie.
Jerry Maguire. Hey, I was close.
Close.
But people are bored with the income. Give me the money. It's the McDonaldizations of society. We want it. We want it now. Only this can change with the government mandating high schools start spending less attention to idiotic topics and more attention to reading, writing, and arithmetic and throw in their finance. They spend more time on crap that doesn't matter anymore at all. And instead, they should be teaching people the importance of income and how they have to evaluate their life through the lens of income or their savings through the lens of income. But they don't. So everything comes to you. Every time you go home, you turn, oh, the market hit a new high. The S&P, what, it's hit 10 or 20, I forget, new highs this year already, 20-something, I believe, already this year, new highs. And that's, oh, it's new high, new high, new high. Why does it say, oh, more income, more income, more income potential? No, it's all about the money. Show me the money. And I think that's what causes a lot of problems, even for you VGs. You fixate so much on your damn money, you don't want to spend it. You'd be surprised how many times we run into that issue working with people just like you. You're loathe to spend your money. And you can't bring yourself to it. It's all about growing the money. Instead, it should be about spending it. Stop calling it money. Call it deferred spending. She never mentions this in her old article. In me, if you're asking me to solve it, no statements. You're going to, except once a year, you're going to see how many shares you're buying. And you're going to be talking about your deferred spending is this. Your deferred spending is this. Getting people to understand you're just deferring spending. You're going to spend this money. It's just going to be the older you. She continues, income as a goal should be more prominent from the start, just as I said, and should be how success is measured, just as I said. The investment menu should also offer more income-orientated strategies. The idea is to give people a sense from the beginning how much income they can expect when they retire. It would help ease the transition from working and saving to retirement and spending. The problem is that's very difficult to do because of the variables that you could put into the calculations.
Yeah. Plus, you've got people making inflation adjustments in their mind too, which makes it a little bit difficult. Do you reveal to them a prediction of income in 25 or 30 years? And it'll seem like a really big number, and they'll think, oh my gosh, I can totally live on that. And they don't realize inflation is going to be happening during the next 25 or 30 years. Or do you display it to them in present value terms, an equivalent amount today? And that comes with its own bag of confusion. So it's going to be difficult to, wouldn't be difficult to calculate, although you'd have to decide on what the assumption should be. But understanding it, I think, is going to require what you mentioned a moment ago, a lot more financial education for people, for the general public, so they can understand it.
She continues, there also needs to be more and better annuities. Hallelujah to that. She is correct. Both immediate and deferred. It is impossible for people to predict how long they will live and what their care needs will be. Did you understand that, folks? We'll be talking about this in our approach coming on, the role secure income plays in our belief. The best way to manage that risk is through insurance. Through the magic of risk pooling, people who need care or will live to be 105 are subsidized by people who don't need care or won't live to 105. Everyone gets more certainty, and it's cheaper than bearing that risk individually. She is so right, folks. But she continues, and I agree with what she says next. But people fear annuities for good reason. That's why we dedicate the month of June. It's not to push annuities. It's to keep you from irrationally fearing them, but also from falling victim to the plethora of crappy annuities that are out there and still exists. Trying to teach you the good from the bad when it comes to annuities. I hate annuities and I love annuities. It's a love-hate relationship. She continues, she's talking about annuities. They have gotten a bad reputation both because of the low rate environment, and that is true, low interest rates, low payouts. The low rate environment made them very expensive. And there are also many expensive products with hidden risks and features that people don't need. That's exactly what I was saying that Wall Street does. And in this case, now the insurance companies do. They make it seem much more complex, much more risky, much more opaque than it needs to be. Chris and I love single premium immediate annuities. Simple, straightforward, pure annuity. But the industry is predicated on living benefits, withdrawal benefits, guaranteed minimum income benefits, guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits, pretend accounts, benefit bases. All this verbiage, step-ups, and all these other things that they build into these very opaque, complex, expensive, and ungodly profitable annuities. And they've bastardized the simple single premium immediate annuity to the point nobody wants them, which is too bad because they're the, in my opinion, one of the more ideal annuities for people to consider. So she continues. Finally, America needs to start thinking more creatively about work. And that's kind of where we began this, that sometimes working a long time or longer can be beneficial. One reason the conversation around increasing the retirement age has become so politically toxic is that too many people see work as binary. You're either working full-time or you're not working at all. This makes no sense. The U.S. can find a way to subsidize people who physically can't work in their 60s and still strongly encourage everyone else to work longer. And I kind of agree with that because there are some people who work in very physically demanding careers and they sacrifice for us. Oil field workers, mechanics, plumbers, all these service industries. Farmers, it's tough work. And they sacrificed so we can have all the things that they create, but they can't work longer. What she's saying is maybe we can come up with an equitable way to subsidize those careers if people are willing to sacrifice in them, and other people who are capable of continuing to work a couple more years. Tough sell, I agree, especially in today's society. Show me the money. They all, gimme. And the push now for a four-day work week and work less, but give me the same pay. And it's going to be a hard pill to get people to swallow. And I think the society is going in the wrong direction. We want more for less, not more for more. But she continues, it may be part-time work, which many people can do into their 70s. Staying engaged in the labor force is incredibly valuable, both financially and mentally. But proposing solutions I have learned is the easy part. Making changes is all but impossible. Risk aversion and bad incentives are embedded in the retirement industry, that excavating them would take a whole other column. And I would say the fees, the ungodly, overly profitable fees embedded in the current retirement industry of 401k balances and IRA balances and AUM fees and godforsaken difficult annuities with embedded fees galore inside them. That's going to be hard to break because it's so profitable and these industries give to politicians like crazy. She says, though, to give just one example, even changing what a statement shows is hard. Record keepers who have a tedious and harder than it should be task of keeping track of what's in everyone's 401k accounts each month have no desire or incentive to change how anything is measured. And that is powerful. In my conversation with people on Wall Street, as she ends with the last paragraph, I often say that I love being a retirement economist because it offers both satisfaction and security. It's satisfying because figuring out how to make retirement work better for more people isn't actually that complicated. And it's secure because while there is always an audience for ideas on how to solve the retirement problem, no one has much as of an incentive to act on them. At least no one in the industry.
Right. So it kind of falls on you to act on your own behalf and take the steps that the system doesn't take for you. If you're going to wait around for the system to be fixed, good luck. I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, and not in our generation's lifetime, in my personal opinion. Could there be a small, subtle change over a long period of time and maybe something revolutionary 50, 100 years from now? Possibly. But for now, the burden of dealing with this, I'll call it ineffective retirement system, is upon you, the retiree. And we'll do our best to help you out as much as we can, but it does pretty much fall on the retiree to deal with many of the things she's pointing out.
Exactly. And that's kind of the lead in into the next series of shows. And we'll start that next week.
Yeah.
And again, feel free, please. If you're going to share in this whole series, what should we name it so people can put it in the subject line, either as a Q&A or a discussion?
How about just the process or the approach or something short like that so it's easy to put into the subject line?
The process or the approach? I'm okay with either of those. So if you want to just kind of put dialogue means you just want us to kind of chat about it. So you should just put dialogue on the process shows or the approach shows. I'll get what that means. Or Q&A on the process or approach. Then I'll know which category to put it in. But we value and we'll want your thoughts, your feedback, pro and con. And we'll share both, and we'll continue to try to teach you why we do things the way we do. And of course, the how. Most of you know the how, but it's the why that to me is incredibly important. And we are going to share with you a new addition into the fun number calculation that in May will hit 1 year. And I told Chris after 1 year, and if we like it and use it, and we do like it, and we have been using it with everybody since May, let's share with our listeners now so they can incorporate this too into their calculation. So there's going to be new things you're going to learn. There's going to be feedback. There's going to be dialogue. And of course, the hows and the whys.
Yep, sounds good. So if you do want to send in your own feedback as we walk through this series, just send that directly to Jim, to his email, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And in the subject line, again, dialogue, and say about the process or something along those lines, and that'll catch his attention so that we can pull those as soon as they come in so that we can deal with them each and every week as we walk through this latest series on our overall approach to retirement planning. We really appreciate everybody listening, and thank you in advance for participating in the upcoming shows. And Jim, you have a great day. We'll talk soon, and everybody else will be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.